Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Let's start with an article from NutritionFacts.org. Why there is so much commercial corruption in nutrition. The prevalence of chronic diseases such as diabetes has skyrocketed, as has the number of articles published about diabetes in medical journals. Why does our wealth of academic knowledge not translate more directly to improving the human condition? Perhaps our overattachment to the reductionistic mindset that proved so successful with acute deficiency diseases may actually represent an obstacle to success battling chronic disease. These days, health seems to have been reduced to a highly commercialized commodity in which we marketed all sorts of high-cost, high-tech tests and treatments of dubious value with substantial risks attached. This is worrisome because most of the things that make us healthy and keep us healthy are cheap and largely available without professional help or commercial prodding. This isn't to say modern medicine can't work miracles, but what about the big picture? That is, what about the 80% of death and disability caused by preventable diet-related diseases? What about the field of nutrition? It's become about profits and products and extracting nutrients from whole foods so they can be repackaged and marketed. But food is best eaten whole. Eat the broccoli and the blueberries, not some broccoberry supplement. But the reason there aren't more studies on whole foods is fairly obvious. You can't patent them. Why should a company spend a lot of money, time, and effort to convince you to buy broccoli when any other company can sell it to you? That's why the field of nutrition can be more about marketing profitable products than educating people about the fundamentals of health and wellness. For example, the benefits of whole grains over refined grains is commonly attributed to fiber, which enables the food industry to whip out fiber-fortified Fruit Loops and make you feel all better. Let's consider this ingenious study. Burkitt and colleagues thought the extraordinarily low rates of killer chronic diseases in sub-Saharan Africa were due to all the whole plant-based foods they were eating. This turned into the fiber hypothesis, the reductionistic thought that fiber must be the magic bullet active ingredient. What happens if we put it to the test? What if we compared two groups of older women getting about 6 grams of grain fiber a day, but one group mostly from whole grains and the other mostly from refined grains? Who do you think lived longer? If it was just the fiber, there shouldn't be much difference because both groups ate the same amount. In fact, the whole grain group lived longer and with a significantly lower mortality rate, which implies that it may be all the other wonderful things in whole plant foods linked to fiber that may confer important health benefits above and beyond the effects of fiber itself. That's why fiber supplements wouldn't be expected to offer the same benefit. Indeed, food, not nutrients, is the fundamental unit of nutrition. As Dr. David Katz has pointed out, our culture doesn't want to hear that the active ingredient in broccoli is broccoli. It wants to know what supplement it can take. And sticking to that same theme, we're going to go to a blog entry from Food Politics. FDA approves qualified health claim for omega-3s. I love the FDA's qualified health claims for food products because they are so patently ridiculous. These are health claims so poorly supported by science that the FDA insists on a disclaimer. What's their point? Companies can use them for marketing and put the disclaimer in tiny print. The latest is the FDA's response to a petition from the Global Organization for EPA and DHA Omega-3s, which asked the FDA to approve 5 health claims. The FDA did its own review of the literature and quite sensibly concluded that evidence supporting such claims is too weak to take seriously. Instead, the FDA said it would allow the 5 qualified health claims if somewhere on the package it included. However, FDA has concluded that the evidence is inconsistent and inconclusive. Absurd as all this may seem, the approval of qualified health claims is considered a win for the omega-3 industry. Why does the FDA allow such claims? Because Congress said it had to permit claims even if evidence was insufficient to back them up. Sigh. Okay, well, backing up to that first article when they were talking about fiber, let's dig into that a little bit and look at that topic. This also from nutritionfacts.org. Where do you get your fiber? Vegetarians and vegans are all too familiar with the question, where do you get your protein? Well, we can finally put to rest the question of whether vegetarians get enough protein thanks to a large study that compared the nutrient profiles of about 30,000 non-vegetarians to 20,000 vegetarians and about 5,000 vegans. 5,000 flexitarians, people that are vegetarian most of the time, and 5,000 pescatarians, those that eat no meat except fish. The average requirement is 42 grams of protein a day. Meat eaters get way more than they need, and so does everyone else. Vegetarians and vegans average 70% more protein than the recommendation every day. It's surprising that there's so much fuss about protein in this country when less than 3% of adults don't make the cut, presumably because they're on extreme calorie-restricted diets and aren't eating enough food, period. But 97% of Americans get plenty of protein. There is a nutrient, though, for which 97% of Americans are deficient. That nutrient is fiber. Less than 3% of Americans get even the recommended minimum adequate intake of fiber. That's something we really have to work on. On average, we get only about 15 grams a day. The minimum daily requirement is 31.5, so we get less than half the minimum. Men are particularly deficient. If we break down intake by age and gender, after studying the diets of 12,761 Americans, the percent of men between ages 14 and 50 getting the minimum adequate intake is zero. The only nutrient Americans may be more deficient in than fiber is potassium. That is, 98% of American diets are potassium deficient. Not surprisingly, plant foods are the premier source for potassium. This deficit is stunning in that dietary fiber has been protectively associated in population studies with the risk of diabetes, metabolic syndrome, cardiovascular disease, obesity, and various cancers, as well as high cholesterol, blood pressure, and blood sugars. Therefore, it is not surprising that fiber is listed as a nutrient of concern, reported by the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee. Protein is not. One problem is that most people have no idea what's in their food. More than half of Americans think steak is a significant fiber source. By definition, fiber is only found in plants. There's no fiber in meat, dairy, or eggs, and little or no fiber in junk foods, those processed foods. Therein lies the problem. Americans should be eating more beans, vegetables, fruits, and whole grains. But how are they doing? 96% of Americans don't eat the minimum recommended daily amount of beans. 96% don't eat the measly minimum for greens. And 99% don't get enough whole grains. Nearly the entire U.S. population fails to eat enough whole plant food. Those eating completely plant-based diets triple the average American intake of fiber. Plant-derived diets tend to contribute significantly less fat, saturated fat, cholesterol, and foodborne pathogens, while at the same time offering more fiber, folate, vitamin C, and phytochemicals, all essential factors for disease prevention, optimal health, and well-being. And the more whole plant foods, the better. Actually, a completely whole food plant-based diet gives 75 to 100 or more grams of fiber a day, in stark comparison to the overprocessed omnivore standard diet in America. So get your fiber and all the great stuff that comes with it through a plant-based diet. Okay, let's move to the public health news and research roundup, where I round up public health information so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up, from The Guardian, indoor carbon dioxide levels could be a health hazard, scientists warn. Indoor levels of carbon dioxide could be clouding our thinking and may even pose a wider danger to human health, researchers say. While air pollutants such as teeny particles and nitrogen oxides have been the subject of much research, there have been far fewer studies looking at the health impact of CO2. However, the authors of the latest study, which reviews current evidence on the issue, say there is a growing body of research suggesting levels of CO2 that can be found in bedrooms, classrooms, and offices might have harmful effects on the body, including affecting cognitive performance. The team says crowded or poorly ventilated classrooms, office environments, and bedrooms have all been found to have levels of CO2 that exceed 1,000 parts per million and are spaces that people often remain in for many hours at a time. Air-conditioned trains and planes have also been found to exceed 1,000 parts per million. Indoor environments are much more a concern presently, and for many people, that is where they spend 60 to 80% of their time. Although projections suggest by 2100, some large cities might reach outdoor CO2 levels of 1,000 parts per million for parts of the year. The team found a number of studies have looked at the impact of such levels on human cognitive performance and productivity. In one study of 24 employees, cognitive scores were 50% lower when the participants were exposed to 1,400 parts per million of CO2 compared with 550 parts per million during the working day. The team add that rising outdoor levels of CO2 will mean rising indoor levels, a situation that could be exacerbated by greater use of certain air conditioning units, people spending more time inside, energy-saving building techniques, and increasing urbanization. Any health impacts, they add, might be particularly problematic for children or those with health conditions that might exacerbate these effects. Okay, next up, from the Center for Health Journalism, most kids on public coverage have parents who work for big companies, new study finds. The conventional wisdom is that kids are on government health insurance because their parents are unemployed or work at small businesses with meager benefits. A study released debunks that theory. Research from the Policy Lab at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia found that the majority of children insured through Medicare or the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, more than 70% have a parent employed by a large company. The study really demonstrates that public insurance really plays a big role for working families in the U.S., says Doug Strain, a researcher at Policy Lab and the study's lead author. It goes back to the escalating cost of health care, cost families and employers aren't really able to keep up with. What that signaled to us is even those families who worked at jobs thought of as having robust benefits are being priced out of insurance markets, Strain said. The group with the lowest rates of kids on Medicaid or CHIP, 14.4%, were parents employed by the public sector. That's compared to 71% for large companies and 14.5% for small firms. We need to have really intentional conversations about children's health insurance in the U.S. Every year, it costs families more money to get the same coverage or even lesser coverage than the year before. Okay. Moving on to a story from Science Daily. International drug development processes and policies are irresponsible and must be reformed. More than half of new drugs entering the German healthcare system have not been shown to add benefit. Bate Weiseler and colleagues at the German Health Technology Assessment Agency say that international drug development processes and policies are irresponsible and must be reformed. Between 2011 and 2017, they assessed 216 drugs entering the German market following regulatory approval. Almost all of these drugs were approved by the European Medicines Agency for use throughout Europe, yet only 25% were judged to have a considerable or major added benefit. In 16%, the added benefit was either minor or could not be quantified. And for 58%, the available evidence did not prove an added benefit over standard care in the approved patient population. The situation is particularly shocking in some specialties. For example, in psychiatry, neurology, and diabetes, added benefit was shown in just 6% and 17% of assessments, respectively. Some people have argued that limited information at the time of regulatory approval and thus widespread use by patients is the price to be paid for early access to innovative drugs, explains the authors. The reality, however, looks quite different. For instance, an evaluation of cancer drugs approved between 2009 and 2013 showed that most had been approved with no evidence of clinically significant a meaningful benefit on patient-relevant outcomes, such as survival and quality of life. And several years later, little had changed. What's more, post-marketing studies often do not happen, and globally, regulators do little to sanction non-compliant companies. Evidence also suggests that many of the investigated drugs added benefit only in subgroups of patients. For the overall patient population, the current output of drug development may thus be resulting in even less progress than our assessments suggest. Clinicians and patients deserve impartial and complete information on what to expect from a certain treatment, including information on the benefit of alternative treatments or no treatment. But given the current information gaps, this is not possible. As a consequence, patients' ability to make informed treatment decisions consonant with their preferences might be compromised, and any healthcare system hoping to call itself patient-centered is falling short of its ethical obligations. They believe that regulators should become far less tolerant of shortened drug development programs and instead should demand robust evidence from longer-term and sufficiently large randomized controlled trials to prove efficacy and safety, which in parallel could be used to collect data for health technology assessment. Information gaps could be closed further by a mandatory requirement to conduct active controlled trials. Rather than waiting for drug companies to decide what to develop, they could define the health system's needs and implement measures to ensure the development of the treatments required. I guess the moral of this story is that this is a worldwide corporate pharmaceutical industry-driven problem, another outcome of profit-driven medicine that actually transcends national state boundaries. Okay, next up from Marie Claire, the burgeoning benzo crisis. When Rachel Ziegler was 22, her doctor prescribed 0.5 milligrams of Xanax once a day to treat generalized anxiety and panic attacks. "I don't recall ever discussing a potential stopping point," says Ziegler, who works as a chemistry lab technician at the University of Illinois, "but I do remember asking her if I would become addicted." Ziegler says her doctor minimized the risk, telling her, "Oh, you'll be okay. You'd have to take it like 3 times a day for 3 months to get addicted." But after about 3 months, the psychiatrist wrote her a new prescription, then another, until before she knew it, she'd been using Xanax for 6 years. Xanax is the most well-known brand in a class of drugs known as benzodiazepines. Other popular brands include Klonopin and Ativan. Benzos, as the drugs are culturally known, are sedatives for the age of anxiety, popular pre-flight fear quellers, and an instant blunter of life's sharp edges, breakups, deadlines, funerals. They're readily prescribed and passed around friend groups like brunch recommendations. And they've gotten shout-outs in everything from rap songs to the New York Times columns. Benzo-praising memes say it loud and proud. Our brains need help, and these drugs are the solve. But we don't talk enough about the consequences of use over time and withdrawal, or how women are disproportionately impacted. Women are twice as likely as men to have anxiety disorder, and thus also twice as likely to be prescribed benzodiazepines. Between 1996 and 2013, benzodiazepine prescriptions increased by 67%, from 8.1 million to 13.5 million. The increase in use and misuse has led to a concerning spike in deaths. The overdose mortality rate involving benzodiazepines for women between the ages of 30 and 64 increased by 830% between 1999 and 2017, according to a January 2019 report by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Often women don't know what they're getting into. Most people taking psychiatric drugs these days do not get an adequate explanation about the nature of the medication, says George Dawson, MD, a Minnesota-based addiction psychiatrist. That was the case for Summer Schley, a 26-year-old waitress in Valley View, Pennsylvania, who was prescribed Klonopin to help her sleep when she was 18. I didn't know what the term tolerance meant, she says. I never did pills or even drank alcohol, so I was completely unaware of what I was given. Drug packaging states physiological dependence can occur even when they're taken as prescribed, but it doesn't explain dependence is widespread among users who take the drugs for longer than 2 to 4 weeks. And many do. Between 2005 and 2015, the number of people using benzos for 6 or more months increased by 50%. Anyone who uses these medications long term is going to experience tolerance and withdrawal, says Wilson Compton, MD, the deputy director for the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Common withdrawal symptoms include increased anxiety and heart rate, gastrointestinal symptoms, mood instability, dizziness, and cognitive difficulties. Joseph Garbley, medical director at Karen Treatment Centers, a Pennsylvania-based nonprofit dedicated to addiction and behavioral health care treatment, education, and prevention, says benzo withdrawal is the worst we deal with. Jen Chobinard, who was prescribed Klonopin for PTSD, experienced stabbing pain in her eyes, elbows, and feet, ringing in her ears, insomnia, stiff joints, and trouble concentrating when she went off the drugs. She also experienced rapid weight loss, dropping about 30 pounds. People were like, "You look fabulous," says Chenard, 33, a graduate student at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada. And I'm like, "Oh, I'm recovering from a drug addiction I didn't know I had." The best way out of this burgeoning crisis is a simple one. We should really look at limiting the number of patients on chronic benzodiazepines, says Stephen DeLisi, MD of the Hazelton Betty Ford Foundation, a national nonprofit addiction treatment provider. Part of the problem in our healthcare system is that doctors spend 10 or 11 minutes with each patient. That is not a good way to treat anxiety. There's a tendency to want to use medication for everything. Other methods, like therapy, take longer to work, but may be better in the long run. Often the solutions are outside of the pill bottle, developing healthy coping strategies and dealing with life on life's terms. Like many users, Ziegler developed a tolerance, taking up to 4 milligrams to get the same effect she did at 0.5 milligrams. I had to keep taking more to get the anxiety relief that I needed so badly, she says. Eventually, no amount seemed to be enough. In 2017, she spent a weekend withdrawing in agony in my parents' bed when she was supposed to be at a wedding. That's when I finally came to terms with the fact that a drug had me completely under its thumb, she says. I was enslaved, and it was 100% terrifying. It took Ziegler about 4 months to taper off the drugs, a period marked by panic attacks, her body temperature oscillating between sweating and shivering, and what is known as benzo rage, which she describes as the adult version of a toddler tantrum. The last pill she took was in August 2017. Benzodiazepines are extremely appealing because they work too well too fast, and Americans are all about the quick fix, says Ziegler, now 29. But it's pretty clear now we are paying the price. Okay, and perhaps a related story, this from Science Daily. Psychiatric diagnosis scientifically meaningless. A new study published in Psychiatry Research has concluded that psychiatric diagnoses are scientifically worthless as tools to identify discrete mental health disorders. The study, led by researchers from the University of Liverpool, involved a detailed analysis of 5 key chapters in the latest edition of the widely used Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM, on schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, and trauma-related disorders. Diagnostic manuals such as the DSM were created to provide a common diagnostic language for mental health professionals and attempt to provide a definitive list of mental health problems, including their symptoms. The main findings of the research were psychiatric diagnoses all use different decision-making rules. There is a huge amount of overlap in symptoms between diagnoses. Almost all diagnoses mask the role of trauma and adverse events. Diagnoses tell us little about the individual patient and what treatment they need. The authors conclude that diagnostic labeling represents a disingenuous categorical system. Lead researcher Dr. Kate Alsup, University of Liverpool, said, "Although diagnostic labels create the illusion of an explanation, they are scientifically meaningless and can create stigma and prejudice. I hope these findings will encourage mental health professionals to think beyond diagnoses and consider other explanations of mental distress, such as trauma and other adverse life experiences." Professor Peter Kinderman, University of Liverpool, said, "This study provides yet more evidence that the biomedical diagnostic approach to psychiatry is not fit for purpose. Diagnoses frequently and uncritically reported as real illnesses are in fact made on the basis of internally inconsistent, confused, and contradictory patterns of largely arbitrary criteria. The diagnostic system wrongly assumes that all distress results from disorder and relies heavily on subjective judgments about what is normal." Professor John Reed, University of East London, said, "Perhaps it is time we stopped pretending that medical-sounding labels contribute anything to our understanding of the complex causes of human distress or of what kind of help we need when distressed." Woohoo! Well, how's that for a fresh perspective? I'm not an expert in that field, but wow, that's something to think about.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted. Or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Well, I don't know about you, but why don't we end the show on some good news? This from energynews.us. We won. Environmental activists claim victory after Detroit incinerator closes. Citing poor air quality and environmental racism, residents of the majority black neighborhood surrounding the plant had long fought for its closure. The recent shutdown of the largest municipal trash incinerator in the U.S. marks the end of a long-fought battle for a majority black neighborhood that has for decades fought a constant stream of pollutants and pungent odors of trash. Activists have spent decades fighting the incinerator, known as Detroit Renewable Power, which burned 1 million tons of solid waste from 13 counties in southeastern Michigan each year to create steam electricity, according to Breathe Free Detroit. Most of the waste came from whiter, more affluent communities, placing the burden of disposal on a mostly African-American, lower-income community. Classic environmental racism, said Kim Hunter, an environmental justice activist with Breathe Free Detroit. Breathe Free Detroit is a campaign that collected nearly 15,000 petition signatures starting last year demanding Detroit Mayor Mike Dugan shut down the incinerator because of its link to air pollution. The plant closed down March 27th, though the threat of hazardous toxins still lingers within the residential area of the incinerator. The site serves as a transfer point for garbage shipments and will send waste to a nearby city. Hunter reveals key factors that helped in the push for the facility's closure. We may only know later what finally brought us justice and closed the thing, but I know that elected officials generally respond to demands from big numbers of constituents, which the signatures represented. Hunter felt motivated to fight against the incinerator as he compared the grim realities of his own Detroit neighborhood to the clean air of northern Michigan. He recalls how the first protests ranged from marches to people chaining themselves to fences near the construction site of the incinerator, originally operated by Combustion Engineering Incorporated and owned by the city of Detroit in 1986. We were just trying to educate while the studies were being conducted by environmental opposition groups about our cause, said Kathy Rashid. One of the early protesters, Rashid remembers feeling euphoric during those moments of public resistance, working with other members that were fighting for the same cause. They made sure to have enough money collected to bail each other out of jail, she said. That unyielding commitment to justice and clean air paid off. We won after 33 years, Rashid said over the phone. Everything we ever said about this poisonous monstrosity has borne out. What environmental destruction and money wasted. They should have listened to us. Kim Schroeder has lived near the incinerator for more than 20 years and said she has seen asthma and lung problems run rampant in her neighborhood. Everyone smelled not the smoke, but the sickly sweet smell of rotting garbage. There was a period of almost 6 years where I could not allow my kids to play outside on the weekends because the smell was nauseating. It was a vast area, but what is more dangerous is what we could not smell. While activists and community members are thrilled the incinerator is closed, there are many who question the timing of the closing along with the increase in Detroit's property values. Detroit is getting new investment from developers and from middle-class white people who are moving into areas previously neglected. Michigan State Representative Isaac Robinson disagrees. Gentrification did not cause this shutdown, he said. If the activists did not fight, if we did not kill the contract in a neighboring city, Westland, if there were no pending lawsuits, if there were no limits to control set by the state, if there were no pending legislation putting pressure on the company, if we did not recruit others to join the coalition, it would still be open. Well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. Or if you'd like to re-listen to this show, any previous show, or get queued up for future shows, take a look at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Again, that's toppun.com, TOPPUN.com, /blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.